This 1001 Songs is a book, and the book by Toby Cresswell, which is about 1001 Songs, needlessly to say. In fact, he says in the foreword, he says, "So, this is a book about 1001 songs. There is no number one, there is no canon. Some of the songs are better than others. Each has its own qualities. These are 1001 songs that will enrich your life and broaden your palate. Some of these songs are terrible. John Lennon's Imagine, which I don't think we've played to date, is, in my opinion, that's Toby Cresswell's opinion, not mine personally, pretentious and insincere. But I know that I'm in the minority here. On the other hand, some songs, I believe, should be the epithesis of Western art, like, say, Tommy James and the Shondells' Hanky Panky, which you may think to be rubbish, but beyond opinion, this book will, I hope, provide some background about the tunes and the point of view from which you can hear things differently, and perhaps you can discover gems and rediscover classics." That was his statement of intention right here at the beginning of the book. But right now, we've got a fair chunk into the book, and like, see, what did we finish? We finished last week with Elton John and Tiny Dancer, which means that this week we're right in with the Rolling Stones and Coming Down Again. In late 1972, following their enormously successful United States tour, the rift between Jagger and Richards widened. Jagger with his new wife and his jet set life, and Richard with a raging heroin habit. Richards was truly an exile at this point, with drug arrests and tax problems keeping him out of the UK and France. The Rolling Stones moved to Jamaica to record at Dynamic Sound in Kingston. Richards was not the only one with problems. Producer Jimmy Miller and engineer Andy Johns were both also falling apart from drugs. Melody makers Michael Watts, who was in Jamaica for the Goat's Head Soup sessions, noted that he, square brackets Richards, looked very, very wasted and very frail. You'd expected this tough guy as he looked, as if you could blow him over, which of course emphasized his myth and made him seem all the more interesting. I think that it became a terrific strain for Jagger to hold this guy up. Coming Down Again is Keith Richards at his best. The song has the ambiance of a dream, so laid back that it could fall over at any moment. The texture is dense and smoky, and all the playing is subsumed into the lotus-eating mood. It's clear from the song that these people are going nowhere fast, but it's the musical embodiment of the phrase, elegantly wasted. This is the Rolling Stones and Coming Down Again. Showing the Rolling Stones and coming down again right here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as presented by Seth Tetley Jones and selected by Toby Cresswell. Next up on this admirable list of 1001 Songs is The Eurythmics and Here Comes the Rain Again. Dave and I wrote Here Comes the Rain Again one afternoon in a room in the Mayflower Hotel in New York. I don't know if Annie Lennox actually talks like that, but that's sort of how she sings, so you know. But that's what Annie Lennox said about the writing section that involved a wrestling match on the hotel room floor. The phenomenal success of the Eurythmics was due to Stewart's innovative approach to pop songs and Lennox's... Lennox's soul-bearing singing. Here Comes the Rain Again moves on from synth pop of earlier records with the addition of a string section, but you still have the quirky arrangement with its absence of a chorus. You have the melody that borrows from Torch songs but doesn't quite go to the same places. Lennox is at her finest here. Most of her best work deals with her struggle with anxiety and depression. "I lived like that for years, some sort of verging on suicide," she said. "I certainly don't mean that I'd ever do away with myself, but it's as if I toy with the idea for a long time, and now I feel I'm coming out of it. No matter how much you want to get out of that sort of thing, or how much help you get, it's a very hard thing to crack, and in the end, it's come entirely from within yourself. But, oh wait, there's more. But although these bad experiences can be horrific, with a bit of luck and a lot of grit, you can also turn them into something creative, and I do believe in self-improvement, and I do not think that one is always a victim, not at all." Yeah, so this is the Eurythmics and Here Comes the Rain Again. That was the Eurythmics, and here comes the rain again, right here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4. Now, today, there have been some car keys lost on Palm Beach, so if you find any car keys or house keys lost on Palm Beach, and there's very important irreplaceable keys, can you please hand them in to the police station? You know, if you've been walking your dog, etc., etc., on Palm Beach, and you happen to have noticed a set of keys, or you happen to notice some tomorrow, etc., etc., please make sure you hand them into the police station, because there are some people who are getting very distressed about them right now. Now, this is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and next up we've got The Hollies and Carrie Anne. The Hollies' first claim to fame was that they took over the Beatles' gig at the Cavern Club, where Mop Tops moved on to bigger and better things. When the Mop Tops moved on to bigger and better things, sorry. The Hollies, who named themselves in honour of the Texan singer-songwriter Buddy Holly, were one of the better groups of the British beat boom. History has passed them by, largely because they were so nice. The Hollies' sound was based on harmony singing, especially the beautifully blended voices of Alan Clark and Graham Nash. Their sweetness was no match for the Rolling Stones and other more colourful artists. The Hollies, however, could really sing, and at their best, they were amongst the leaders of their field. Their best-known song is the Graham Goldman-penned Bus Stop, but it was on Carrie Anne that the voices really flew. Carrie Anne was one of their first compositions and became a hit in the US and the UK. It's squeaky clean, but also built on amazing vocal dynamics over a three-chord melody. In its way, it is at least as clever as anything the Byrds were doing. Indeed, guitarist Tony Hicks was listening to the Byrds on the Hollies' 1965 tour of Norway when he got the idea for this masterpiece. The song was finally cut on the 3rd of May 1967 in two takes. This is The Hollies and Carrie Anne. Hollies here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4. And of course, we're doing live streaming on our website, which is www.waihekeradio.org.nz. And then you can also find our Facebook page, which is facebook.com, funnily enough, / Waiheke Radio, one word. And next up here on 1001 Songs, presented by me, your host, Seth Titley Jones, we've got Lucinda Williams and Essence. Lucinda Williams should be at the very centre of country music. She is an example of the best of what country at least says it is, says Emmylou Harris back in 1995. The songs on the Essence album are slightly darker, more seductive, and more elusive than on her breakthrough Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, which we actually had earlier in the series. Essence is mostly sadder than its predecessor, no doubt assisted by the eloquent, mournful guitars of Ryan Adams and Charlie Sexton, and David Mansfield's plaintive violin. The Essence, the title track, is playful in a narcotic sort of way. Williams is no stranger to the wilder side of life, having spent many years on the road doing damage to herself. In the song, sometimes she uses heroin as a metaphor for a lover, or vice versa. It's sometimes hard to tell. For instance, I am waiting here for more. I am waiting by your door. I am waiting on your back steps. She does it a bit better than I do, but then again, I haven't practiced. I am waiting in my car. I am waiting at this bar. I am waiting for your essence. And if I remember rightly, they have this very nice sort of thing going on. But anyway, I'll play it for you in a minute. So let's not get carried away. The song is a shimmering piece of modern country production from Sexton and treated guitar from Ryan Adams. There's come hither quality and a wariness at the same time. The ambiguity and rich production make the song quite in country while still relying on the conventions of a country song. Without labouring the point too much, this is an album about dangers, low esteem, lost love and solutions, drugs, passion, God. The title track is the abridged version. Taken as a whole, it's an expedition to the end and back in under 6 minutes. Actually, I've got that particular version there, if I remember rightly. I've got the nice, big, epic version for your listening pleasure. This is Lucinda Williams in Essence.
She shivers in the wind like the last night.
Baby, sweet baby, you're my drug. Come on and let me taste your stuff. Surprise, you gone.
That was Lucinda Williams and Essence right here on Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4. Just a reminder, there have been car keys and house keys lost on Palm Beach today. If you find any on Palm Beach, please hand them in to the police station. It's very important. Their owners are feeling very frenzied and worried right now. Next up, here on 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, as presented by me, Seth Titley Jones. We've got Bob Dylan and the band. No, we don't have Bob Dylan. Not quite yet. We've got Madonna instead. With Like a Prayer, Madonna took the manipulation of media and PR to a new level in the 80s and right into the 90s. Her shows were outrageous. If there was a holy cow, she ran into it. It came to a head with Like a Prayer. Having accepted a massive sponsorship deal from Pepsi, Madonna then released her first Pepsi-sponsored video and caused a massive storm. The song had spiritual overtones. The video took scandal to it. New level, with Madonna not only eroticizing Christ, but a black Christ at that. Pepsi immediately cancelled their sponsorship. Madonna had found the limits and the big core of reality of corporate sponsorship of the arts. The religious overtones of Like a Prayer were apparently not motivated, especially by a desire to cause controversy. Spirituality is really important to me. Madonna told The Face, but I don't feel so inspired to write songs about it. I mean, I go to church, but I go to Church of England. I go to Catholic churches. I go to synagogues. I partake in all religions, and it's in my bones. I'm Catholic because that's how I was raised, and I'm just as intrigued by Judaism as I am by Catholicism. Like a Prayer is beautifully crafted devotional song in the guise of perfect pop. God is in the drum machine. It's a nice bit of wordsmithery from Mr. Cresswell there. God is in the drum machine here in Madonna and Like a Prayer.
God?
Like a Prayer by Madonna there. Wasn't meant to rhyme, I just sort of randomly said there. Yeah. You're listening to Waiheke Radio on 88.3 and 107.4 FM. That's right. You're listening to 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, as selected by the old Australian music journalist, Herbert Creswell, and presented by yours truly, Seth Titley Jones. This is I Heard It Through the Grapevine by Marvin Gaye, and written by Barrett Strong and Norman Whitfield. Don't think I've ever heard of either of them. I don't know, maybe you have. Motown put The Factory in Hit Factory. Songwriters, producers cut tracks with the house band and then allocated the house stars to particular tunes. No song illustrates this process better than I Heard It Through the Grapevine, which Barrett Strong initially gave to Gladys Knight and the Pips' fellow inmates, the Isley or Isley Brothers, I really should know that, The Miracles, also cut the song. A month after the Pips recorded Grapevine, producer-writer Norman Whitfield recut the track for Marvin Gaye, accenting a more churchy Ray Charles feel. Whitfield replaced the acoustic piano with an electric Wurlitzer. For the drums, he wanted an Indian sound with the accent on the toms. He slowed the track down to a voodoo chant pace and built a powerful groove. I came up with this little idea, the piano, the bass line figure, said Barrett Strong. We thought it was great. I thought of this title. I heard it through the grapevine because I'd heard people sing it so much, but nobody had ever written a song about it, and we just went from there. Gladys Knight's version reaching number 2 in the charts, and the Gaye version was shelved and took a year of insistence before Motown Supremo Berry Gordon agreed to release the track. He's reported to have said to Whitfield, mention that fucking record again and you're fired. The song stayed in the vaults until uncovered by archivist quality control manager Billie Jean Brown, who also needed a filler for a Gaye album. A Chicago radio station began playing the album track and it took off. I Heard It Through the Grapevine became Motown's biggest hit of the label's first 20 years. And the song was also interpreted by Creedence Clearwater Revival into a swamp rock jam. Even Marvin himself was apparently ambivalent about the song at first. I was being a good artist at the time, he said in 1972. They tell you, Marvin, you gotta come in and do this tune because this song is a good song for you and it was written by so-and-so, and so come right in there and be a good guy and cut it, okay? And that always bugged me. As generally I say, go and take your song and shove it. But this particular time I said, oh hell, I'll be a good artist. But it was the Lord who was working, and he knew that I should have gotten to do it, so I did. And that's why it became a hit. That's Marvin Gaye. And I Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Things to make me blue with some other guy.
Marvin Gaye, and I heard it through the grapevine, right here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4 FM. Next up, we've got the John Barry Orchestra with the James Bond theme. The producers of Dr. No, the second James Bond film, but the first with Sean Connery, engaged a London songwriter, Monty Norman, to score the film. He began the job, but apparently due to time pressure, the producers thought he needed some assistance. John Barry, the leader of John Barry and the Seven, was brought in. I think he's made a mistake there. Oh, Mr. Crestwell, he says it was brought it. He means brought in. Norman and Barry finished the theme, and Barry went on to score the film. Relying on inventive horn arrangement and swinging quite through the percussion, James Bond theme evokes danger, erotica, and... exotica. Is that... Yeah, that's an X. Not an R. There, and sex appeal. Mostly, though, it's modern in its sound. A touch of R&B with jazz phrasing makes it swing like the 60s were just about to. Barry's father had operated a cinema, so he ran a jazz band for many years and understood the marriage of the two so well. John Barry came into our lives when we were making Dr. No. You called director Terence Young. We had someone else doing the music, and although the score was all right, we didn't have anything exciting for the title music. And I think it was someone at Chappelle who said, "You listen to him." And he had this little band called the John Barry Seven, came in and wrote this Bond theme, the original theme, especially when accompanied by the silhouette animation in the original title sequence. There's everything you need to know about James Bond, and no character before or since has been so tied to a piece of music. Yes, that's the James Bond theme by the John Barry Orchestra. Yes. What do you think of my Sean Connery impression? It only contains one word, but what a word, and the only word that he really uses throughout the films anyway. Not that I've seen them all, but I've seen a few, and I've seen enough to know that that's the main word he uses. Of course, it only really works for me on radio. Though having said that, I'm with a bit of padding and bits of false beards and things. I could make myself into that sort of old woolly bearded overweight 90-year-old fellow that Sean Connery is now. Having said that, we're moving away from Sean Connery and toward Bob Dylan, who Mr. Cresswell has been... let's face it, he's certainly been favouring Dylan over his 1001 song so far. This, if I look in the index, I mean, it contains... blah, 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 Bob Dylan. Dylan, D, D, Y, D, D, Drury, Duran, Dylan Bob contains 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Or contains lots of references to Bob Dylan in this book, 1001 Songs, the Great Songs of All Time, and the Artists, the Stories, and the Secrets Behind Them, to give it its full title. This one right here, though, is from 1991, and it's Blind Willie McTell. Blind Willie McTell was born in 1901. Like many blind black men of the time, unable to perform manual labor, he became an entertainer and later a preacher. McTell's compositions were amongst the most popular folk blues of the time, including classics such as Statesboro Blues and Delia. He died in 1959 at the height of the folk renaissance, just as his music was reaching a white college audience. One college student at the University of Minnesota picked up on McTell's song and sang some of them in 1960 in coffee houses. Later in life, when he was the greatest songwriter of his generation, he would return to Willie McTell's Broken Down Engine for one of his albums. Blind Willie McTell, regarded as one of the finest Dylan recordings, was cut for the Infidels album in 1983 and laid unnoticed even by Dylanologists. Dylanologists. Yes, though. Dylanologists. Must remember that word. For 8 years until uncovered for the bootleg series volumes 1-3. The tune is based on the traditional St. James Infirmary. You know, I went by St. James Infirmary. Summer baby there. She was stretched out at a long white table. So cold, so sweet, so fair. Can't quite do the Louis Armstrong voice. No, but this isn't Louis Armstrong anyway. I'm not sure if even his version is in here somewhere. I must dig that out for your listening pleasure at some point. Oh, no, I'll forget. I always forget these things. Anyway, the tune is based on the traditional St. James Infirmary. The song Dylan refers to staring out the window of the old St. James Hotel. From that window, he looks across the world and sees only power and greed and corruptible seed. And Blind Willie McTell comes at the end of Dylan's preaching period. No longer writing evangelical songs, he returns to writing apocalyptic ones. He sees the corruption of the modern world and hears Blind Willie McTell's music and the sound of history, which is more of the same. This is Bob Dylan, Blind Willie McTell.
Seen the arrow on the doorpost, saying this land is condemned. I travel through East Texas, where many martyrs fell, and I know no one can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell.
Was Bob Dylan there and Blind Willie McTell. You've been listening to 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. For the second to last live show of the year, and after after next week, we're going to be taking it back to where it all began, and we're going to be starting out with number one again. And we're going to be going through a repeat of the series, you know, just in case any of you have missed any episodes, you know, that you can get that into your hot little hands, ears, throughout the next 6 months. Yeah. No, having said that, you can catch a repeat of this show at 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, and then I'll be back next week at 8 p.m. Monday evenings, as usual, right here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4. You can also hear it live streaming on the net if you happen to be listening that way at www.waihikeradio.org.nz.